In this portion of our discussion, we'll focus on an 8-step process in the positive prevention of employee problems. If you look in the progress guide, you'll see a model of these steps. Later in our series, we'll be giving you a second 8-step process for the positive discipline of problem employees. An ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure, and managerial experience certainly bears out the fact that creating conditions which prevent employee problems later on is the smart way to go. If we fail to do those things which keep people in the straight and narrow, let employees get off track, and then try to correct the problem, it's just a lot more work than it needs to be. Admittedly, it's a lot of work to get people into the grooves of proper performance to begin with. But if we don't get them into those grooves, and if we're not careful about finding ways to put up protective barriers that will keep people working right, then we're going to have to do some other work. And that other work is less pleasant, costs more, and is more risky to our careers. And that other work is the work of dealing with people once they've gone off track. So my earnest invitation is to listen carefully to what we're about to discuss, because if you've got some problem people now, this conversation will show you how to prevent more of them. The first step in the 8-step process for positive prevention is to select good people. It's possible to hire good people, and it's possible also to hire people who are an accident just waiting to happen. In some instances, because of the sloppy selection methods used in the past, you may now be living with a problem person, perhaps selected by your predecessor, and that person has been a problem from day one. He or she came to your organization with a set of inappropriate and inadequate skills, and now you're living with the result. If selection had been better, a better person might be in that job. So I would suggest that you give lots of time and attention to the selection process. One way you can do this is to simply impose a more intensive interviewing procedure. The interview remains the primary means of selection by which most people are hired into most organizations. If you examine the process used in your organization, what you may typically find is that one or two people do most of the hiring for your department or division. Furthermore, you're likely to find that the amount of time spent in that hiring process is relatively short. By that I mean usually less than an hour for non-technical people. While this is not a program on personnel selection, here are some simple rules of thumb, practical guidelines of how one might intensify the selection effort.
Number one, conduct longer interviews.
Simply interview for greater periods of time than you now interview. If you now interview for 30 minutes, interview for an hour. If you interview for an hour, interview for two. The likelihood that the candidate will say something that gives you a better insight into the way this person's mind really thinks is going to be greater the more time you are exposed to them.
Number two, include multiple interviewers.
Have more than one person do the interviewing. Multiple interviewers will increase the range of questions and the range of perspectives that this person has to deal with in the course of discussing their future with your organization. Bill may find out some things about this individual that Harry doesn't, and Harry will learn some things that Ruth didn't. And as the three of them swap information after the interview sessions, they will reach a far more accurate decision than if any one of them had had to do the job alone. That's a known and simple principle from decision making. Two brains are better than one.
Number three, have your prospects return for follow-up interviews.
An interview is the world's phoniest situation. This person is there in the best clothes they have. They are on their best behavior, with their best manners. You'll never see them looking that good or acting that courteous again. If the first impression was positive, then have them back for a second interview. If the second impression is also strongly positive, you may in fact have a winner. It was reported recently that at a famous New York club, a busboy candidate has to go through 5 one-hour interviews. One of the things this does is give you multiple impressions of the person over time. Sometimes there are things we can't quite put our finger on in the first interview. But as we get to know this person before he's on our payroll, we come to either like or dislike the person. Yes, it may be inconvenient for the candidate, but it will certainly measure his or her interest or motivation in your job, and it will save you from the disaster of hiring somebody completely inappropriate.
Number four, schedule an inconvenience interview.
At least one of the interview sessions ought to be very early on a Monday morning. People who are substance abusers tend to binge on the weekends, and it's possible that at 6 o'clock Monday morning, you'll see some of the symptoms of their chemical dependency. Nervousness, popping breath mints, bloodshot eyes, clammy skin, and so forth.
Number five, apply the tardiness knockout.
This is a somewhat controversial principle of interviewing, but one that I believe the evidence supports. Stated simply, if they come late to the interview, don't hire them. Now, it's possible they have a good excuse for why they're late, but except in very rare circumstances, say a flash flood or tornado, don't hire them. It's true that if you follow the rule of not hiring latecomers, you might be ruling out a good person, but the probabilities are against you. It is in the interview stage when people are trying to make their best impression. That's when they're most motivated to measure up in your eyes. They want this job. If with all of that motivation going for them, they still can't manage to get to the interview on time, are you willing to bet they're going to come to work on time once they're on your payroll? The evidence indicates otherwise.
Number six, conduct interview training.
Putting all the people in management in your organization through a training seminar on interviewing makes a lot of sense. In the seminars that we conduct, we see managers learning new and better patterns of selection technique. Discussing and sharing experiences helps them sharpen their approaches, and it helps the organization change practices which have not been effective.
Number seven, evaluate your prospects with a formal assessment.
Under this approach, an outside service is generally retained to assess people on various characteristics, things like intelligence, aptitude, personality, interests, and values. In a typical testing process, the candidate would take 8 hours of tests, answer about 4,000 questions. Those test response patterns can be grouped and matched to validated profiles of what it takes to be successful in certain jobs. Management gets a 5 to 7 page report along with a sheet profiling all the test scores. While that kind of a technique doesn't do your selection for you, it does provide an additional screen that you can use above and beyond your own efforts in interviewing. My suggestion to clients who are interested in these more advanced procedures is to try them once with a particular candidate. Try it as an experiment to see what you learned that didn't come up in the normal selection process. A second way to test out whether these assessment measures are really any good is to go through the process yourself and see what their report is on you. A lot of executives who have tried that experiment find it scary that they can be called so accurately.
Number eight, check references as a part of your hiring process.
There are some skillful ways in which one can get at least some basic information. They may tell you that the person is absolutely wonderful, terrific, walks on water, and wouldn't harm a fly. To test the validity of that good news, ask the test question, are they eligible for rehire? If the answer is no, this suggests that there is some discrepancy between their words and the reality of the former employee's performance. On the other hand, it's possible the former employee is not eligible for rehire because the company has a policy that prevents it. In other words, they truly may be a good person, but they're simply not eligible for rehire. If you get a no on the rehire question, you must then ask the next question. Does your company have a policy that prohibits rehiring people? If they say no, then there's a good chance that there's been a problem with this person and that the reference isn't leveling with you. Some organizations go beyond their own personal reference checking and use various credit report services which can dig out additional pieces of evidence. The case I'm making is that the best way in which to prevent having to deal with problem employees later is to try and select people with good attitudes and adequate skills up front. If you do that, you'll save a lot of headaches down the road. Another way to prevent problem employees is to review your orientation procedure and realize how important it is. Orientation, as it's practiced in most organizations, is a joke. A person comes on board, gets a half-morning session with the personnel people who show him how to fill out the insurance forms and the disaster escape routes. Then he's thrown into his unit. Typically, there's a lightweight approach to orienting the new employee to the job in the organization. See if your organization measures up. Does it follow the guidelines you'll hear in this section? One way to view the orientation needs of employees is to keep in mind that they are 100% disoriented when they walk in the door. They don't know you. They don't know the people. They don't know the procedures. They don't know the work. They don't know the customers. They don't know where to hang their hat. They don't know where the washroom is. Management's decision is truly not one of whether there should be an investment in orientation, but whether they want to allow a totally disoriented person to function within the organization. In many organizations, management has chosen to force people to learn the ropes by themselves in a process of trial and error. In that process, these bumping into walls employees create problems. They injure their self-image, get undeserved reputations, and start almost immediately to get off track. The reason they're off track is they were never put on the track. They were not told where the track is, when the train leaves, or where they're supposed to get off. It's not fair. It's not honest. And it doesn't make any sense at all for a manager to leave an employee in that state. Far from resenting initial guidance, your new hires will be quite receptive to it. Managers who neglect or postpone orientation may find themselves with a potentially effective employee who is starting to flounder.
Kathy, I've been reviewing your performance records, and I'm a little puzzled. The quality and quantity of your work aren't quite what I'd hoped for. Tell me, how do you think things are going?
Okay, I guess. I thought I was doing a good job. I work just as hard as everyone else.
Kathy, you're still fairly new here, and I want you to understand what I expect from you. Compared to your co-workers, your performance volume is a little low, and the quality of your writing needs to improve. I know you're working hard and you don't have an attitude problem, but I do think I need to help you with writing reports and meeting deadlines. Would you mind letting me make some suggestions?
No, not at all. I could really use the help.
See what a difference some interest can make? At Sony, new employees go through 8 weeks of initial orientation. At IBM, 16. General Motors' new Saturn plant provides for substantial employee involvement and heavy orientation, even though most of the people to be hired are former UAW employees from other locations. The trend and pattern in American industry is now moving toward extremely heavy orientation. What should the orientation include? Obviously, the housekeeping tasks necessary for personal support in the organization, how an employee gets a paycheck, how to fill out the benefit forms, and those kinds of things ought to be covered. A second area should be lots of training in terms of what the corporate values are. Employees like to know something about the history of the organization, why this organization is important, the kinds of customers, the kinds of products, and what kind of contribution the firm is making to society. What about the founder? What did he or she struggle with in order to make the organization possible? The history of the organization is extremely important because history is a series of stories, and stories convey the culture and values. Some time ago, McDonald's first hamburger stand in Chicago was going to be closed. The traffic pattern in the area was no longer as good as it once was, and McDonald's announced they would be tearing the building down. There was a flood of calls and letters from all across the United States suggesting that management had its head in the sand because it didn't appreciate its own history. The fact is that McDonald's has become part of American culture and American history, and yet management of the enterprise didn't at first see the value of their own history. There is now a sort of McDonald's museum housed at that restaurant. It's an amazing thing to see how often managers do not understand the importance of their organization, and hence do not relay that importance to their employees.
What is it new employees want to feel? I think it's important that they see themselves as part of an organization that's going somewhere, that has a noble purpose, that it has values. It's important they view the work they do as meaningful. But if nobody ever explains it to new hires, I don't know how they're supposed to magically generate all this understanding on their own. A third major area new employees like to know about are the specifics of their jobs. What are the tasks they're supposed to do? How fast are they supposed to do them? What is the normal interaction between this unit and other units, or between this job and other jobs that depend on it? If we're going to prevent employees from becoming problem people, they need to know the standards of performance. How well do they have to do this job? What does it take to please the boss? What is it that they'll have to do in order to get a salary increase? What do they have to do in order to get a compliment? In some organizations, this information is treated like it's a big secret. In some organizations, managers couldn't answer those questions because they don't know themselves. But the best organizations are those with people who sit down very early with the employees and explain to them exactly what it takes, so there isn't any mystery. When employees know exactly what they have to do in order to get ahead in your organization, they'll go for those targets. If you'll tell them what the objective of the game is, they'll go after the objective. People are game players. That's not a bad label. And to help them win in the game called work, just tell them what the rules are. But if you don't tell them the rules in Monopoly, if you don't tell them what it takes to pass Go, if you don't tell them what it takes to dominate that board and win by the rules, then they're going to go off on their own and play the game by other rules. So why don't we spell out exactly what it takes to succeed in this system? If you're going to do this job well, it's going to take a substantial addition of time and resources. I don't think this is the kind of thing that's possible to accomplish in a morning or even in a day or two. How much time it will take for your particular situation, I don't know. Increasingly, we see companies devoting days, weeks, and even months to the orientation process. These organizations want people to firmly understand, early in their employment life, what is expected of them. To the extent that your organization matches that profile and seems to match that intensity, you're probably doing well. Organizations that neglect orientation run a very serious risk of disoriented employees who, in turn, disorient the entire organization. What do I mean by that? In a highly mobile society, fairly high turnover within organizations is becoming the norm. That factor, plus rapid change and growth within an organization, creates substantial percentages of people who have less than 2 or 3 years of service. As the mass of disoriented workers multiplies within the organization, they wind up being the majority. And that results in changing the culture and the general way things are done in the firm. Our concern over orientation is in part that we want employees to adjust correctly, but we also want to preserve our own organizations. We simply have to defend against this massive amount of ignorance that walks in the door. The second guideline in orientation is to place people correctly. Ask where the best place to orient this individual would be, and who would be the best person to do the job. If your organization is like most, there are some departments and some managers you wish had less influence than they now have. And there are others that you wish you could clone throughout the rest of the organization. The basic rule is this: always assign new employees to the best units, best supervisors, and best co-workers. Some units within the organization are probably high-performance units. They have it together. Rather than trying to retool all of the existing units, you may find it more practical to send new employees to that high-performance unit for at least a brief rotation period. Additionally, assign them to the best supervisor, that man or woman who is the taskmaster, who sets very high performance expectations, who seems to have a knack for getting people excited and turned on to their job responsibilities. Employees assigned to such a leader are more likely to understand what they should do than employees assigned to a mediocre manager. In like fashion, if you team them up with the best worker within that department in a buddy system, that buddy, with a very positive attitude and good performance history, will be a better teacher than almost anyone else in the unit. On the other hand, if you team new people with just any bozo, don't be surprised if things turn into a circus. So let's consider what can be done in the original stages of employee connection that will get people on the right track. The third major step in preventing problem employees is to utilize strong supervisors. Winners make winners, and losers make only losers. Why is it that one of the best ways to prevent problem behavior is to assign employees to strong supervisors? Research has determined that strong supervisors act as a linking pin, tying their people to the rest of the organization. Problem supervisors, on the other hand, do not form a positive link with their people, and their employees are disconnected from the rest of the organization. They are disconnected from its values, its practices, its spirit. In a classic Harvard Business Review article entitled Pygmalion in Management, it was reported that supervisors tend to set high expectations or low expectations, and that employees tend to perform at those levels. Imagine what would happen to a new employee who encountered a weak supervisor, one who did not strongly support the values of the organization, and one who set low expectations for that employee's performance. The research shows that there is a higher probability that employees in that unit will be a problem in the future. In short, weak supervisors create problem employee behaviors through their lack of leadership and direction. It is imperative, therefore, that new employees not be assigned to such people in the first 12 months of their career. John Hancock Life Insurance Company makes a practice of assigning new salesmen to the strongest managers in the field, thereafter rotating them to people who may be less strong. What that firm determined was that once employees had been put in a high-performance groove, they did not decrease their own performance when they encountered weaker supervisors later on. In fact, these rightly trained new employees even wondered whether the later supervisors knew how things were supposed to be done. The role modeling the supervisor does for new employees helps change behavior and teaches them how to behave. Good supervisory bonding is more likely to occur if the supervisor spends a good deal of time with the employee and is reassuring and helpful and supportive. It is less likely to occur if the supervisor is distant and harsh in communicating. To a large extent, employees need less of a boss and more of a teacher and coach in their first year of employment. One of the key characteristics of good supervisors is their understanding that they have to lead their disciples. A disciple is a follower, and if the employee is to be a follower, he or she must see some leadership in the unit. Unfortunately, a lot of supervisors are only figureheads. Where there is no excellence in leadership, it is unlikely that there will be any excellence in followership. Ask yourself one of the test questions for any organization. Just how good are our supervisors? And if the basic talent and aptitude are there, have they been exposed to the concepts of role modeling and bonding? In your own supervisory behaviors, do you make it a point to get acquainted, to really know each person you work with? Inexperienced supervisors say they feel they shouldn't be involved in their employees' lives. They feel uncomfortable or out of line in involving themselves in an employee's personal situation. While this may be correct from some logical or abstract viewpoint, from a practical perspective, it could not be more wrong. Effective managers jump into their employees' personal lives with both feet. The best managers seem to know their employees. They know their families. They've been in the workers' homes or have had them in theirs. Because of this closeness, effective managers feel free to speak up and to make quick, correcting comments that warn the employee when there's difficulty at work. One gets the feeling of being a family when you're working in such a unit. Have you linked the employees in your unit to yourself? Have you linked them to the organization by virtue of your behavior? Step four in preventing problem workers is using the employee. Where did we ever get the idea that we shouldn't use people? How did the phrase using people get a negative meaning? I guess it smacks of negative manipulation, using people. Well, I suggest that one of the biggest reasons why people become problems is because they haven't been used well or enough. I remember the story a good friend of mine told. He had come to work for a major company with a recently acquired MBA from Indiana University, one of the top business schools in the United States. The first task on the job to which this young eager beaver was assigned was to clean out the storage case where all the old records and forms were kept. He said, "The first message my management gave me was that I was only good for janitorial work." I, too, remember vividly the very first assignment that I was given when I got out of college. I thought I was pretty terrific, that I was God's gift to this particular organization, that I was going to set all kinds of fast-track records. My first assignment was to redesign a 3x5 card that was used for enrolling employees in their insurance coverage. I thought to myself, well, this certainly isn't very taxing of my wonderfulness. Nevertheless, I will do it with great gusto. So I sat down at my desk and 60 minutes later produced for my boss's review said sign-up card. He indicated it looked okay to him. He would take it down the hall to the departmental manager's meeting the following week. To make a long story short, he took that card and its many revisions down the hall for the better part of 6 months. With each turndown, my initial confidence and my initial self-image became more shaky. Is it possible that I, with my great insights, did not have the intelligence to design a 3x5 card? Before this particular project ended, this company had me spend weeks of my life in forms design seminars. I burned up the long-distance wires with forms consultants. I amassed the world's largest library of books on forms design, and still I couldn't satisfy those nitpicking perfectionists. My mother used to say that the only reason I stayed in school longer than some of the other kids was because I was dumber. And this project was beginning to make me think she was right. It took me 6 months to figure out that the problem wasn't with the form, but with something else in the organization. To test that theory, I resurrected the original design that I had created 6 months before and sent it back down the hall, only to have it approved. How was I used? How are we using people? Particularly, how are we using them in the early days of their career? An old theory of motivation pointed out that people come to the job having a certain level of expectation, LOE. They expect to find certain things. These expectations are not necessarily realistic, but nonetheless, they are present in the person's thinking. They hope for a certain relationship with their boss. They anticipate certain group dynamics. They hope the job will be that great pinnacle of joy they've been looking for. But this level of expectation, or LOE, encounters a second level called the level of reality, or LOR. And the level of reality is often less than the level of expectation. Suppose we give people with a high LOE a low LOR in a job that is beneath their capabilities. Knowing their capabilities, they encounter now a level of reality that is substantially lower. That means they will be used at levels that are beneath their capabilities. That creates a dissonance, creates frustration, anger, resentment. On the other hand, a person might come on the job hoping to be able to do fairly well, and the LOR is generally a pretty good match with what they expected. If the job given to them is perhaps slightly beyond their present capabilities, slightly more challenging, slightly more demanding, there is an energy created here too. In this case, the energy is positive.
At first, I wasn't sure I could handle it, but I did fine. It's as if my supervisor always knew I could do more. She had more confidence in me than I did. I'm really learning a lot.
What's been found is that employees are more than willing to do the occasional scut work job. Everybody, I think, is mature enough to understand there is going to be some routine work that just has to be done. There's always some unpleasant task nobody likes to do. But the real question is, what is the pattern, and how does the level of reality match up to the level of expectation? If we're continually assigning people to a level of reality that is below their self-perception, their self-image, their own internally perceived LOE, it is going to create a lot of negative feelings. These people are going to be very angry. And over a period of time, they'll become uncooperative. We are sowing the seeds of new problem employee behaviors. One way to use people is through selective assigning. Good supervisors have always understood the principle of selective assigning. You've got to figure out what would be a good stretching experience and throw a few plums in for every person in the unit occasionally. Jobs that are incessantly routine or mundane ought to be redesigned, automated, computerized, or given to people who have very little ability. There's no such thing as unworthy work. It's a question of what we're asking people to do continually and finding the best way to use them. My suggestion is to use the capabilities of the people around you. Not so that people will feel used in the negative sense, but so they will feel useful, that is, experience a fullness of use. Yet when I ask management audiences what percentage of their people are being utilized at 80, 90, or even 100% of their capacity, I get percentage estimates of only 10 or 20% of the people. What this means is that we are systematically not using people. We are systematically not freeing them up to do what they could do. We are putting people, not just a few people, but millions of people, into jobs and job structures that are less than the persons themselves. This creates a dehumanizing effect. It creates unions. It creates resentment. It creates the spectacle of people running out the door at the end of the shift. Another aspect of employee utilization is to examine the adequacy of job structures. In an organization with large departments, sometimes natural career ladders will emerge, giving people a chance to move from one job to another. If we can't be flexible in the content of every job, can we be flexible in giving people the opportunity of moving from job to job? It has always interested me to see the dichotomy which exists in managers who believe in personal freedom in running the country, but who can't see the value of personal freedom at work. When we create freedom at work, it means that employees can take some responsibility for their own lives and move themselves into a better fit where the level of expectation and the level of reality are going to be closer. I don't think it's fair to assume that the supervisor should have to be able to place every person and know people so well that somehow he takes the role of the state in making all of these decisions. So what can he do that will put these decisions into the hands of people who have to do the work? In addition to career ladders, are there job posting systems in place? Job posting systems basically give employees an opportunity to walk through the door into another job. It gives them a chance to raise their hand, a sense of control over what they're doing, and a feeling of freedom within the workplace. In addition to the concepts of using people, selective assigning, and setting up more creative job structures, I would add one other approach under the headline of people utilization. The concept is managing by objectives. MBO is no longer as prevalent in the United States as it once was. I think there is a direct correlation of that fact with the decline of American productivity. A lot of MBO systems did have some failings and problems, probably the biggest being that they became overgrown, ponderous, got forms heavy and bureaucratic. But MBO is basically a simple process by which a manager and his employee sit down and decide what that associate is going to do in the next 90 days. At the end of the 90 days, they examine what was done and how well it was done. The concept of planning for people's performance is particularly important when we're dealing with other supervisors who may work for us or for professional and technical people. The point of all of this is that when we keep people on fairly short control periods, like 90-day increments, it's much easier to spot when they start going off track. But if we never set up any kind of a system, then we have no systematic way of reviewing performance or determining when problems are occurring. Lee Iacocca credits a planned performance approach as part of his success in the turnaround of the Chrysler Corporation. He reports that when he first started with Ford many years ago in marketing and sales, he noticed that the stockholders of the company insisted on receiving a quarterly report on the company's progress to the corporation owners. A quarterly earnings statement was important to monitor how effectively management was doing its job. Iacocca reasoned simply that if it was good enough for the shareholders, it was good enough for him in terms of monitoring how well his people were doing. Consider what is actually happening with a planned performance approach. Employees gain both freedom and control over their boss by getting the boss to buy into a shortened, select agenda of tasks to be done. From the boss's point of view, he is getting staff associates to buy into doing the items that he most wants to get done. And so the boss says to himself,
I'm getting him to set some dates. I'm giving him what he's always saying he doesn't have enough of, which is the freedom to do the job. I'm going to give him the authority levels he needs. I'm going to give him the support. I'm not going to rain on his parade. But in 90 days, we're going to sit down and see where he is. And I'm going to hold him accountable for results.
Both parties in this transaction gain what each respectively wants, the freedom and the control that are both necessary if work is to be accomplished in a correct manner. Do your people have a planned performance approach, or are they left to wander through the fog? Do they have the prioritizing that really establishes what ought to be happening, or are people left to guess and figure this out through the magic Ouija board of management? Employees who function under a planned performance contract are those that are less likely to get out of the groove and become problems, and they're also the ones that are most likely to have the fun and joy of successfully achieving their goals. And goal attainment becomes a self-reinforcing mechanism that keeps them wanting to achieve new goals. The fifth step to prevent problem employees is to provide ongoing education. Over time, every job tends to evolve in such a way that its demands exceed the capabilities of the job holder. In every job, the knowledge base keeps shifting and expanding. However it comes about, people's skills have to be updated. If they're not updated, these people are going to become less and less capable and will have the beginnings of yet another problem person. Therefore, the corporation has to take on a nurturing role in sponsoring and even enforcing opportunities that will provide for both personal and professional growth. One of the smartest things that you can do is to create an atmosphere of professional growth and an education orientation within your organization. Education has to be considered a lifelong learning.